with us this week. Haven't checked the attendee list, and I always kind of hold my breath a little bit, wondering what Dr. Berry's going to tell us. I feel like I've been hearing COVID is still hitting pockets of our county family, and we actually had to close the solid waste transfer station in the last week because of COVID. So it's affecting everyone in the community at this point. And so good morning, Dr. Berry. We are glad you're with us today again.
Nice to be with you. I would say that by and large, my COVID news is good this week. So no need to hold your breath too tightly. Nationally, case rates are largely stable, though we are seeing a slow increase in hospitalizations at the national level. We're not seeing an increase in death. We think most likely that is because COVID is starting to get into some pockets of the population that have previously been better protected. So even though case rates aren't significantly surging nationwide, when we see high-risk people get exposed, hospitalizations can happen, especially in pockets of the country where vaccination is less common. In Washington state, we're seeing a very similar picture. We're seeing that case rates by and large are stable or even slightly downtrending at the state level, but hospitalizations are still slowly creeping up, particularly as COVID-19 starts to spread more on the east side of the mountains. In Jefferson County, we actually have a little bit of good news. Our case rates are actually going down at this point. We have diagnosed 4,897 cases of COVID-19. That puts us at a case rate of 539 per 100,000, 562 per 100,000 with a 16% positivity. We have one person currently hospitalized for COVID-19 for a total of 136 hospitalizations and no deaths, no new deaths to report. So we've had, unfortunately, lost 30 of our citizens to COVID-19, but no new deaths from COVID-19 in the last week. In Clallam County, we're actually seeing a very similar picture. So we've diagnosed 13,984 cases of COVID-19. Our case rates are now at 539 per 100,000 in Clallam County, so very close to the Jefferson County rates, with a 17% positivity. We have no one currently hospitalized in Clallam County for a total of 409 hospitalizations so far in this response and 117 deaths. So by and large, looking at COVID-19, you'll see kind of variable reports on where we are in this process. And I've certainly seen a lot of kind of breathless reports about COVID-19, particularly around BA4 and 5. But right now, we're not seeing data that really supports significant concern about BA4 and 5. So BA5 has become the dominant variant nationally. In Washington state, it's not quite yet. It's 40% of our isolates are coming back BA5. BA5 is a subvariant of Omicron. It is more transmissible, increased rates of reinfection and breakthrough infection compared to even original Omicron. So it is very possible to get BA5, even if you've had a recent infection with COVID-19. Still seeing pretty good protection for about 90 days after a prior infection, but we do have some reinfections within the after 30 days that we're starting to see now as well. So the big takeaway there with BA4 and 5 is that prior infection alone, not enough to protect you from subsequent infection. The best protection comes from being vaccinated and boosted. And many of us, unfortunately, had breakthrough infections in recent months. And so you still have very good protection from that combination of immunity, but we're not seeing very good protection from one infection alone. So if you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, haven't gotten your booster yet, really important to go forward and do so. One thing that we are not seeing is a significant rise in severity related to BA4 and 5. I have seen some reports about individual cases where one person might have had more severe symptoms, and then it ends up in the media and people say, oh no, we have a new variant that's significantly more severe. Looking at the data nationwide and worldwide, we're not seeing a significant rise in severity related to BA4 and 5 at this point. We'll of course continue to evaluate that and keep monitoring the variants as they move forward. But the basic takeaway for BA4 and 5 is they are more transmissible. You can definitely get reinfected with them and in relatively short order, but they're not significantly more severe than any of the subvariants of Omicron that we have seen before. So the same things that worked before work now. Getting vaccinated and boosted reduces your risk of severe disease. Wearing a high quality mask reduces your risk of getting and giving COVID-19. And when you do that in indoor spaces. So the same stuff we've been talking about here for a long time still works well. But you can't count on just an infection to keep you immune. We've been talking about that for a while. And you can't count on vaccine alone to keep you from getting COVID. We're not seeing very good protection against mild disease at this point. The main thing that protects you from contracting and giving COVID is wearing a high quality mask. What your vaccine does is dramatically reduce your risk of getting severely ill from COVID, which is really important. We don't want our citizens getting severely ill. We don't want an overwhelm of our hospital system. And thankfully, what we've seen in this most recent wave is that the high levels of vaccination in our community really protected us from that kind of surge that we've seen in other places. So it does still matter, does still make a big difference, but it doesn't make you permanently immune to getting mild disease. So if you're sick, get tested so that we can find out whether or not it's COVID-19, and wear a mask when you're in indoor spaces with other people. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions from our commissioners.
I have a couple. Glad to see good news. I guess something I'm going to ask you every week, and I got a question about it too, is our test ascertainment still high? Can you kind of, do you think our decreasing numbers are because we have decreasing numbers or because people are getting fatigued about reporting their tests, their positive tests?
I do think we still have relatively high case ascertainment rate compared to other places. I think part of why we're actually seeing a decrease is because we actually mapped our surge in a way that lots of other places didn't. They just kind of held at this low number because they stopped tracking home antigen tests. But we did. And so we really are seeing that curve go up and then back down. So I think it is real. We're not seeing a significant drop off in case ascertainment rate locally. Certainly, we're not getting all the cases. I would say right now, our case ascertainment rate is still probably about 50%. So you want to double the numbers of cases that we have. But that's much better than at the state level, where they're getting about 1 in 5. Of the cases. So you want to take the state numbers and multiply them by 5. So we don't know every case that's out there, but I do think we have better case ascertainment rate than most other places.
And I guess my other question is just, is it time to reconsider our responses? I don't know. It seems like a different disease that we're dealing with. And as Commissioner Eisenhower talked about earlier, the transfer station is down today because of, too many staff and COVID out. And we've missed our first Jefferson Transit route on Saturday as well. I mean, we have service impacts right now, and I know the hospital is as taxed as they've ever been, I think. So I feel like staffing is kind of the most acute place right now where COVID is hitting us, and wondering, is there a path for us? This is, as people are so fatigued by wearing masks that it's hard to get people to wear masks for 10 days after their positive test, So I guess I don't want to put sick people, infectious people back in the workforce, but we're really having impacts that we haven't had before.
Yeah, I think we are definitely still having significant workforce impacts. It's varied who's getting hit by it. So I would say it's not necessarily new workforce impacts from our end, but different groups get hit at different times. I do think it is appropriate to adjust our response. And I think we are adjusting from where we were. It used to be, if you were exposed, everyone that was anywhere near that person was out for 14 days. We're not in that place anymore. If you're vaccinated and boosted, you can come back to work right away. We do ask you to wear a mask after an exposure. In particular, I think that's an important thing. We'll talk some more about masks later in this call because we got a KPTZ question about them. But I think one of the biggest shifts that I think is appropriate is transitioning away from quarantine for people who are up to date on their vaccinations to just masking. And then when we see critical workforce shortages, to even letting other folks come back, but to have them have to mask. Because I do think that we have enough evidence that the masks really do reduce transmission to other people. So it's okay to let someone come back who's been exposed, who doesn't have COVID, while wearing a mask. I also think it's reasonable to let someone come back after day 5 while wearing a mask if they're well enough to work. Some folks are still getting severe enough disease that they're not well enough after day 5. And so I always want to remind employers about that, because we get those calls sometimes that that he can come back at day five, but he says he still can't breathe. And I was like, well, then he can't come back at day five. He's too sick to work the job.
Can I go into that a little bit, doctor? I mean, so after day six, I'm feeling fine. Mm-hmm. I have no symptoms, but I'm still testing positive.
Mm-hmm.
Can I come back to work?
So in a, you know, ideally, if there's enough workforce, we'd prefer people stay out till day 10 after day five. But in critical workforce shortages, we have let people come back at day six. And so for something like if we can't have the transfer station functioning, we'll let people come back later in their infection, but they do have to have stringent masking, and we can work with them on other ways to make sure that they aren't spreading the virus to other people. So can we put them in less people-facing positions? Can we put them in outside positions? We work a lot with companies on making sure that dining facilities are separate for those who are positive, so they don't then give it to the rest of the workforce. We just keep the transfer station shut down. So there's a lot that we can do to help get people back. But I think the biggest is that we don't quarantine as much. If you're positive, it's okay to come back after day five, but wear a mask. That's the ideal.
And you know, my final question kind of on this topic is, you know, we've talked about public sector companies, but I'm sure there's private sector companies too that are going through this. And if they are struggling with workforce issues, is it okay to reach out to the nurse? I mean, how do they help get kind of the technical assistance to make sure they're doing the safest thing for their staff while still keeping their business going?
So that is something we're absolutely happy to help with. So if you have an outbreak in your workplace or you're facing a critical shortage, you can give us a call at the Department of Public Health and we'll talk you through how to make it as safe as possible. Generally, at this point, most of what we're talking about is recommendations, not stringent mandates. So you don't have to worry that you're going to get kind of stringent rules placed upon you. We just help you problem solve how to keep your business functioning, how to keep your customers and your staff safe. And there's a lot of details that we're used to walking people through that you might not think about, like where your employees eat lunch. So please do give us a call. We're happy to help with those kind of situations because we want society functioning. We want people able to access services. And so that's a place where we definitely can still offer support. So please give us a call if you have that happen.
Great. Thank you.
No worries. And I want to do one quick acknowledgement that I think Jefferson County's Jefferson Hospital is being affected a lot by positive staff, but also by what's going on in neighboring Clallam County with Olympic Medical Center. And that's adding a lot of stress on their system right now. Yes, Commissioner Dean.
Yeah, I'm curious, can you give us an update on an anticipated Omicron directed vaccination that we've heard about for this fall potentially?
So there is, the FDA is looking at an updated vaccine, kind of basically booster, that would come for this fall with Omicron subvariants in it. At least parts of the spike protein related to the Omicron subvariant, it would not have actual Omicron in it. And it does look likely that that's going to come forward this fall, probably not until around September or October. So just around the time that most of us would get vaccinated for the flu. I think that is likely that we'll see kind of a fall vaccination recommendation, but not entirely clear yet. Still a lot of data to come out on those, on both whether or not we need them and just some more details on the process there. But I'd say, you know, we all now plan on getting our flu vaccine in the fall, and I suspect that we'll move towards getting a COVID vaccine in the fall too, but still remains to be seen.
I just always look at the meter, the little meter on the county web, the county public health website. So we're still at high, and we said not long ago that as long as we were in the high category, we weren't going to go back to in-person commissioner meetings. And I'm just wondering when that directive changes, or when we might want to rethink that directive based on everything that we know now about what's happening now with the virus. I mean, do we still want to hold that directive and say we're, you know, if we go down into moderate, then we think about having in-person meetings again? I'm still, as the commissioner who has only been a commissioner during COVID, I only campaigned during COVID, I've only served as a commissioner through the pandemic. And this weekend, I spent some time with a lot of my former colleagues at the Maritime Center. I was helping with a wedding there. And they were like, how are you? I mean, you know, they're gobsmacked. They're like, you've only been a commissioner during COVID. How bizarre. And I don't think of it as bizarre because it's normal for me, but I'm starting to kind of push back on myself and say, when do we get to be together again? I want to sit next to Kate and Greg. I want to see people coming into the chambers. I'm fine with hybrid, but how do we think or rethink or shake the etch a sketch on where we're at now?
I think there are ways to do it well. So if there's interest in having in-person meetings, I think the most important is that for staff to wear a high quality mask in those meetings, because especially if we have large numbers of the public coming in, there's a significant risk of exposure to COVID-19. But if there's interest in moving back to in-person meetings, I think that can be done well. And there, the biggest stuff there is mask wearing, increase in ventilation if we want to get creative and we can move outside. I'm sure there's some IT challenges related to that. But anything that we can do to increase ventilation in those spaces can certainly reduce any risk as well, so that we can come back together in-person meetings. I think that's important. I know Jefferson County in-person meetings have been particularly affected by just the type of meeting space that we normally meet in, that's very, very cramped. So if there's, and I know there's work being done right now to look at kind of more open spaces where we could get more people in with still some spacing, and masks recommended in those spaces as well.
I love the idea of outside. That's a good idea, Dr. Berry.
It's nice weather. It's a good time. If it's possible, I would love an outdoor meeting.
Yeah. Thank you. I just have been feeling a little high centered on it. So I'm going to bring it up every week until someone says, let's just do it. This is how we have to do it.
And I know this group is very well vaccinated. So we, you know, the likelihood that any of us is going to get severe disease is low. In county meetings, the only other thing you want to think about is that you don't want an outbreak that would take out the group at once. And so that's why masking is so critical in those spaces, is so that we don't have multiple people contract COVID simultaneously who we need to be able to work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, I'm happy to dig into the KPTZ questions if it sounds good. All right. So one person asked, they said, for someone who has tested negative but has a positive household member, what are best practices? And so what we talked about a little bit before, if you are vaccinated and boosted, if you're all up to date on your vaccines, you don't have to quarantine at home anymore. Even if you have a positive household member, you can go to work, you can go to stores. Best practice is to wear a mask during all those interactions, because it's not, it is very possible to get a breakthrough or a reinfection from a household member. That's your highest risk contact. And so do wear a mask when you're going into those settings. And I would also add to a recommendation to avoid high risk settings. So if you know, if your husband or wife has COVID, I would not recommend then walking into a long-term care facility to visit family members until you know for sure that you're negative. So until you're at least 5 days out, you're testing negative. Adding a negative test, so doing a swab before you go into any high-risk space, if you're going to need to go into one of those spaces, is a good safety mechanism. So say you work in a high-risk space, you work in a long-term care facility, you work in a jail, and a household member of yours is positive. I think adding an antigen test on your way into those spaces is a good way to just make sure that you're not bringing COVID in addition to wearing a mask. That's really the biggest thing that you need to do as a household member. And then if you develop symptoms, as soon as you do a test, if your symptoms persist for more than 24 hours, test again, because we know that you can test negative in the beginning of your infection. This person also asked that if their household member is not separating from them, if they're not masking, they're going to be sharing in the same space, does that change anything? And I would say that does increase your risk of contracting COVID-19. And so all the more reason to mask, test if you're going into any high-risk spaces. But that's really all we would ask as a household member in those spaces. If you are not up to date on your vaccinations, there is still a recommendation to quarantine. But as we talked about, there can be critical workforce shortages. And so the most important thing really is to mask when you're leaving the house, to test if you have any symptoms at all, and test before you enter any high-risk spaces. And that's one way that we can kind of keep society moving while protecting the people around us. Well, the next question is from a person who had an adverse reaction to their Moderna vaccine. So they had a sore arm and a rash, and they're wondering whether or not Novavax is likely to be approved and be an option for them. And so Novavax is an upcoming vaccine for COVID-19 that uses kind of older technology. So a lot of the other vaccines that came forward faster were using kind of newer technology, things like mRNA. Novavax uses the old school, which is a little bit of protein from the virus that they inject directly into you, and an adjuvant, which is something to kind of stimulate your immune system. It does appear to be working quite well. It hasn't gotten full EUA approval yet, but it is likely to. So when that does happen, if that does happen, we are likely to carry it here. And it could be a good option for people who either were reticent to get an mRNA vaccine or who had a reaction to an mRNA vaccine. If you did have a severe reaction to an mRNA vaccine, something more akin to anaphylaxis, definitely talk to your doctor before you move forward with any COVID-19 vaccines, because we want to make sure that this one is different enough to not cause problems. But I know that there are folks who've had some reaction that wasn't quite a truly severe anaphylactic level reaction, but who are reticent to get an mRNA again. And I do think Novavax could be a good match for those folks. Always, if you have any questions about your specific medical needs, talk to your own doctor, but I do think this could be a good match. I know we have a nurse in Clallam County who's been desperately wanting to complete her series, and she's just been waiting for Novavax to get authorized to do so. So I think it could be a good option. And if it does get approved, we'll make sure we have some here. This next person said, asked if we were seeing BA4 and 5 or BA5 in our local cases, and is that responsible for local surges? And so I would say right now, we don't technically have a local surge going on, but in much of the rest of the country, we do. We have seen BA4 and BA5 in our region. But BA5 is becoming the dominant variant in Washington state, and it will become the dominant variant here. I do think actually looking at our sequencing out of Clallam County in particular, we got BA5 a little earlier than much of the rest of the state, and that likely did drive some of our recent surge that is now thankfully starting to come down in our region. This next question is asking about proof of vaccination requirements or vaccination requirements for workers, particularly transit workers, and whether or not those mandates make sense or whether or not they need to be maintained. I would say those decisions are always up to individual employers at this point, and there's pros and cons to proof of vaccination requirements or vaccine mandates for workers. I think in the healthcare setting, a vaccine requirement is very appropriate. It is normal for all of us when we see a healthcare provider to assume that that healthcare provider has done everything they can to make sure that we don't leave that room sicker. And so it's very normal. I'm a healthcare worker. I'm required to be vaccinated against a whole pile of things. I'm required to prove that I don't have TB. There's a lot of things I have to do in order to be considered safe to take care of vulnerable people in a medical setting. And so I do support vaccination requirements in the healthcare setting. I think at this point, vaccination requirements for other industries are a little bit more of a mixed bag. Certainly, the COVID-19 vaccine does a great job of preventing severe disease, and it does reduce your likelihood of transmitting COVID-19 to others, but not as much as it did before. Back when we were in Delta, and if you were vaccinated, you couldn't get COVID and you couldn't give it to other people, I think a vaccination requirement made a lot more sense. But now we're in a different phase where the vaccines reduce your risk of getting COVID, but they certainly don't 100% prevent it. And so your vaccination is much more doing work for you. It's preventing you from getting severe disease. And so I think some of the data to support mandating it for workers is starting to fall away because of the way the variants have changed and because of the amount of breakthrough infection we're seeing. It's still a really good idea, but it's mostly the biggest thing it's doing is preventing you from getting severe disease at this point. Couple other questions. This person asked, which of the Omicron subvariants are here in Jefferson County? Right now, we are seeing primarily BA5 and BA2.12. So we still have kind of one of the older variants circulating out here. Eventually, it will be vast majority BA5, which is more transmissible, more reinfections, but not so far more severe. This person asks, as the subvariants keep coming, is it less likely that a rapid test will pick up BA4 and 5? And it's not. The antigen tests keep working really well to detect viruses. They can be negative early infection, especially for folks who are vaccinated, because as we talked about in detail on a prior call, the first symptoms you're feeling are actually your immune system. So you don't have a very high viral load to spread to other people. So if you're testing negative on an antigen test early in infection, you are unlikely to infect other people. So I don't want folks to worry, but it does mean that we want you to keep testing. So if you are, if you're sick and you tested negative and you're still sick again tomorrow, test again, because what you might be feeling is your body kicking into action to fight that virus. And then you could still turn positive later and then become able to infect others. So do keep testing, but the antigen tests are still working well against these current variants. This next person was asking kind of a little bit of a throwback for data around mask wearing. So happy to dig into that. There have been literally hundreds of high quality studies looking at the efficacy of mask wearing, but this person actually asked for three to list off three studies that they could look up. And we'll make sure that we share this in social media so people can actually see the links on the mask wearing data. There's a couple different things that masks do. So one is source control, preventing you from transmitting COVID to other people. So there was an early paper by Leung et al, L-E-U-N-G, in April of 2020, that was looking at actually just surgical masks for source control. And they looked at people who had coronavirus infections, and then whether or not you were able to culture virus after they coughed or sneezed on a surface that they coughed on. And what we found was that there was actually a 100% reduction in transmitting COVID or in transmitting coronaviruses in this case for those who wear surgical masks. So that's one that you can look up and kind of dig into that. That's just kind of breaking down viral transfer. There's another one by Nelson et al. That was in September of 2021 that looked at what's called secondary attack rates for folks who were masked or unmasked. And secondary attack rates means the likelihood that someone else in your close proximity got COVID when you were positive. And so they saw for people who were masked, the secondary attack rate in that particular round went from 11% down to 1%. So significant reduction in secondary attack rates, not zero, but quite a bit lower for folks who were masked. Another really good one was Andrako et al. And that one actually came out in February of 2022 that looked at likelihood of contracting COVID-19. So protecting yourself based on mask wearing behaviors. And they found that for those, and this is for the general public, not for medical folks, but for those in the general public who consistently wore KN95s or higher, there was an 85% reduction in contracting COVID-19 when they did that in any indoor public spaces. There was a 66% reduction for those who wore surgical masks regularly, and still a 56% reduction for those who wore cloth masks, which is not something we really talk about that much anymore because we have better masks available, but they actually do still provide a lot of protection. There's a really good data brief from the CDC that kind of lists a bunch of these studies in a row, and we can link that to our social media so you kind of click through and dig into the studies. Long story short, masks work really well. We have an overwhelming amount of data that they prevent transmission of COVID-19 to others, and they protect you from COVID-19. So this is really established scientific fact at this point. But if you're wanting to dig into the research to make sure, we'll link a science brief to our website and our Facebook so you can dig around and read those studies yourself. This last one was an interesting one. I had to dig into some data on this, but apparently it is a study that's making some of the misinformation rounds. So I wanted to dig into it a little bit. This person asked for me to comment on a particular paper that's being shared a lot, particularly in kind of anti-vaccine circles, that what showed that COVID-19 vaccination in this paper temporarily impaired semen concentration in people who were donating sperm, so in sperm donors. So I dug a little bit into this one. So this was a paper by an Israeli doctor, a relatively small paper, looking at about 30 sperm donors. And what they found was that in the first weeks after vaccination, they saw 20% reduction in sperm count in these donors. They also saw and demonstrated in the paper that that completely rebounded to a normal sperm count afterwards. And that this is consistent with actually what a little known fact, which is that after any febrile illness, you see a small reduction in sperm count. It's a very normal thing that happens to anyone who has a fever. It's just not something most of us I've probably spent a lot of time talking about, but we do see normally about a 20% reduction in sperm count after any febrile illness. So after having a cold, after having the flu, or if you had a fever from a vaccine. This is a normal human process after we have fevers. And then it does rebound entirely. Of course, this is now getting shared in kind of vaccine misinformation circles as proof that the COVID vaccine causes infertility. And it's very interesting to read this poor Israeli doctor is trying very hard to actually let people know that that's not what his study said. And so it's a challenge when you put data out in the world, people use it for what they want. But I think the key data to know there is that small sperm count reductions are normal after febrile illnesses, and then they resolve. And in this case, they also demonstrated that it resolved. Now, this was a small study. It was only 30 people. And so if this is something folks are wanting to study more, they could certainly look at larger numbers for a study like this. But I also think it's important to acknowledge, as a family doc with an interest in family planning, a 20% reduction in sperm count still means that you have about 80 million highly functional sperm. So please don't think that after you've had a cold or a fever or a COVID vaccine that you can't get someone pregnant, because you can. So please do still use protection if you're not interested in stimulating a pregnancy. So with that, I'm happy to answer any other questions. Okay. Always interesting to see the questions we get on KPTZ, and thank you for the encouragement to dig into some interesting research.
Can I just make one comment? I see a few people raise their hand, and we don't normally take questions during this period, but you can submit questions to KPTZ by emailing them to, I forget the email address.
Have that. But yes, please do. I think this is a really important forum to kind of dig into those things, especially if you're hearing about studies that are getting circulated that make you nervous. And we can dig into the quality of those studies and exactly what the breakdown looks like for that data.
I'm looking for that email. I'm not finding it readily. Thank you, Dr. Berry. Always a interesting mix of questions that you get, and you do a great job jumping from focus to focus. So we really appreciate your ambidextrous nature on this stuff.